Thank you, Peter. We do rejoice in what God is doing in Bangladesh. He and I were visiting just before this hour, and he was telling me that while visiting in the United States previously, he and some others went through the San Francisco Bay Area telephone directory to find people who had names that indicated that they were from Bangladesh, and they contacted them all, and they have organized them together as a church that is meeting in Walnut Creek. So I'm impressed not only with what God is doing through their people in Bangladesh, but in the United States as well. This past week while in Arizona, I engaged in an interesting conversation with a man who told me about a recent episode with his teenage daughter. She is a freshman at the university in the state where he lives. She is 18 years old, attractive, dating a 22-year-old man, not at the university, who is good-looking, and they like each other a lot, and the 22-year-old guy wants to marry his 18-year-old daughter. Now, for reasons that my friend did not fully explain, he is convinced that this guy is not good for the daughter that he loves, and so he told her not to love him. Now, you might want to guess at what her response might be, which was not totally positive. In fact, he said that it is the worst blow-up that they have ever had. That's because most of us don't like someone else telling us who to love, and especially we don't like someone else telling us who not to love. It may even cause a blow-up of any relationship. And yet risking that, God the Father talks to us as straight in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 to 17, as that father in Arizona talked to his daughter. Here's what God, our Father, says to us. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the craving of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever. Now, the central message to what God is here telling us is in verse number 15. It is the simple statement, do not love the world or anything in the world. And that may be enough to make many of us bristle, that God would tell us who and what not to love. And that's because we find the world to be quite attractive and, in fact, very lovable. And our initial response may be, on the one hand, to just blow up, or on the other hand, to more passively simply tune out. But before we do either, let's at least hear out what God has to say in the three teachings that are in these three verses. The first teaching, in verse 15, is about the exclusivity of love. And here the Bible is quite blunt. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him, saying that no one can love both, that we love either God or we love the world, and that a choice has to be made. Somewhat like driving down a road that ends, and you have to go one way or the other. It's a T, and you either go north or south. You can't do both. It's one or the other. Or it's going to vote, and you have a ballot on a referendum that has a yes and a no, and you take your pen in hand, and you must check yes or no. There are no other choices. One is mutually exclusive of the other. So God is here saying that he will not accept mixed allegiance. It is either love him or don't love him. It is either love the world or don't love the world, but it is, if we love God, then we cannot love the world. Now that to some of us seems a rather strange thing for God to say. For does he not elsewhere in his book say that God so loved the world that he gave his only son? If God loves the world, why can't we? And when we pick up the Bible and we read its opening pages and the recount of the story of creation, do we not find that the God who created the world at the conclusion of all that he did summarized what he saw by saying, "It is very good"? If God loves the world, and if God says that the world is very good, why should he forbid us to love what he loves? We need to understand what is meant by the Greek word for world, which is cosmos. It's an interesting word, often used in our vocabulary. The Soviets call those who fly around the world not astronauts, but cosmonauts. And the woman's magazine is called Cosmopolitan. So we, in a sense, know what cosmos is. It's the world, but it is used in one sense in the Bible to refer to the world that God created, the physical world and all that are in it, and is also used in the Bible to refer to the system which humanly governs and controls the world, but excludes God from that governance and from that control. Maybe it helps to strike an analogy. I know that I think for almost all of my life I have been taught, and I have responded positively, to a teaching to dislike and to distrust the Soviet Union and its satellite states in Eastern Europe, countries like Poland and Romania and Czechoslovakia and East Germany. I have, I confess to you, but I think many would confess the same back to me, perceived both the people and the places to be evil, to define them as the enemy. But because of all that has happened in the last several months, both in the Soviet Union and in East Europe, I have had to reforge some of my thinking. And part of what has caused me to do that is to hear the interviews, to listen to the speeches, to read the stories of some of these people and their own attitude toward their own countries. For I see and I hear Romanians who love Romania and Poles who love Poland, but who have hated the communism that has taken over their countries. And I force myself to make a distinction that routinely I have not made in the past. Now, it's true that they have had to live under these communist regimes. It is true that they have been under communist governments, that they have read communist newspapers, that they and their children have gone to communist schools. In a sense, it could even be said that they have lived in communist homes, that they have eaten communist food, and much, much more. And that many around them also loved communism and became themselves members of the communist parties of their countries. In fact, they were wholehearted in it. But then, of course, many did not. For there were some who kept the distinction in their minds between their country and communism. Many of them, I think, were they here this morning to give their own perspective, would say to us that anyone who truly loved Poland did not love communism. That any Romanian true to Romania was not true to communism. In fact, many of those who have gone through the difficulties of the last 45 years would argue that those two things are mutually exclusive. You could not love your country genuinely and also love the system which was destroying your country. They would argue to us that the two, in fact, are mutually exclusive, and it is a clear choice. Well, so it is that God wants us to love our world, the world that he has created. But he instructs us not to love the world system that has excluded him from the governance of the world, has taken over and put God out. Now, in theory, that sounds okay, I guess, but in practice, that is a very, very hard thing to do. Just as it has been a very, very hard thing in these Eastern European countries to remain loyal patriots to the country, but not to the system. And the reason it's hard is because it's hard to be different. It's hard to go to a communist school and not be a communist. It's hard to work in a factory and expect to get promotions and to get along with everybody else and to reject the system and for people to know that. Nobody wants to be different. Very few do. Rarely do I choose to be different. I want to be like other people. I want to fit in. I want to be part of the crowd. And most of us do as well. And that's why it is so hard to make the choice to love God and even to love God's world, but to not love the system that the people around us have bought into and are part of. especially when we go to the world's schools and we eat the world's food and we're part of all the world is that is around us. And yet God insists. He insists that when we love Him, there must be an exclusivity to that love. When Charlene and I were married, we memorized the vows in our wedding ceremony. One of the distinctive features of that is it is the only thing that I remember about our wedding ceremony, because all I did up until that point was go over them in my mind. I paid no attention to anything else that was said or done. And after I finished saying it and got it pretty much right, got her name correct and all those kinds of things, I was so relieved that I didn't pay any attention to anything that happened after that either. But there was a line that was included in the traditional vows that we said to each other. A line that said that, forsaking all others, I will cling to thee and to thee alone, so long as we both shall live. Now that is exclusivity. That means that my life is devoted to her in that kind of a relationship. And that because of that commitment, because of that vow, it excludes anyone else. That I can't choose somebody else and Charlene. The two can't go together, that they are, in fact, mutually exclusive. It is a lifelong choice that I made. It is a vow that I stated and that I have kept, that forsaking all others, I will cling to thee and to thee alone, so long as we both shall live. And God asks the same. God asks us to choose between Him and the world system that excludes Him. A world system that can be very, very attractive, can be, in fact, seductive. That Christians are those who have chosen God and have said to Him that, forsaking all others, I will cling to thee and to thee alone, so long as we both shall live, which is forever. The teaching of verse 15 is that if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. The second teaching in verse number 16 has to do with the activity of love. For exclusive love of God is no mere theory. It is tangible. It is specific. And that also is like my love for my wife. For to cling to Charlene and to her alone not only means what I do in relationship with her, but it also means what I don't do in relationship to other people. Because of the exclusivity of my love for her, that means that I cannot flirt with other women. It means that there are restrictions on who and when I can touch someone else or where I may be alone with another person. That's part of the understanding. That's part of what the relationship is all about. We understand that. We understand that exclusive love for one restricts relationship and activity with another. And so it is with God, that if we exclusively love Him, which He asks us to do, then we are automatically restricted in our relationship and in our activity with others. For everything in the world, the craving of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does comes not from the Father, but from the world. And so we are here given three specifics. Number one, the craving of sinful man. By the way, it is humankind that is spoken of here, both men and women. And this craving is talking about selfish desires that exclude God. Selfish desires that are independent of who God is and what God is all about. The second specific example is the lust of the eyes. If you want, you can simply substitute one word here, and that is greed. Greed, which is looking at things that we don't have and having a greedy lust to get them. The third specific example is boasting of what he has and does. And that's bragging about what we've got, bragging about what we have done, and especially to impress other people, and often in a way that is to build us up and is to put them down. Now, these are supposed to be specifics, and yet I find them personally to still be rather abstract. It's difficult for me to conceptualize and to specify in my own experience exactly what here is being talked about. But I think I found a way. In fact, it's something that if you really want to understand what this teaching is, that you could actually test out this week to come. The way to do that is to take a Bible and to open it to 1 John 2:16, and at the same time, either turn on your television at some time of day when there are a frequent number of particularly national advertisements, or if the time is not appropriate, then take a popular magazine that has a lot of advertising in it, and with 1 John 2:16 in one hand, turn the pages of that magazine with your other hand and look at the ads. For I think that you will discover that much of our American advertising is rooted in a system that follows steps 1, 2, and 3 of 1 John 2:16. Look at ads, for example, for automobiles. Ads that have a car in them, although now there's a series of ads that doesn't even have the car in it. But pick one that has the car in it and look at what else is in the picture. For in many of them, you will find an attractive woman, or a handsome man, or a very large and luxurious house, or some other opulent setting which we crave for. We say, well, I'd like to have her, I wouldn't mind having him, or I would sure like to live in that kind of house. And so it triggers in our minds a desire for all of those possessions, often independent of the automobile, which is not presented in terms of transportation or utility or anything of the kind. And when we see that, what we experience is the cravings of sinful humankind. And then we stare. We look at it. Often, honestly, we look not at the car, but we look at the trappings that are in the rest of the ad. Stare and stare at the woman or the man or the house or whatever it is, until greed starts to seep all the way through us. It is number two, the lust of the eyes. All of this is intended by the advertiser to motivate us to go out and get the car, and we do. So you go out and you buy that car, somehow with the subliminal impression that getting that car will make you either look like that person or get somebody who looks like that person or live in that kind of a house. And when you get the car, you go through a whole series of decisions that have to be made. For example, when to drive it home. You think to yourself, well, my neighbor always mows the lawn at 5 o'clock on Friday afternoons. So 4:30 would be a great time to stop by the dealership and to pick up the car and to slowly, I mean, you shouldn't drive a new car too fast. You need to break it in. And to slowly drive it around the neighborhood a few times to make sure that he sees it. Or, well, Wednesday's my day for the carpool, so why don't I get it instead on a Tuesday afternoon? And then I can pick up all the people in the carpool and they can take a ride in it on Wednesday morning. Come to think of it, though, on Thursday, there's supposed to be a fire drill at the office, and everybody has to come out of the building. What a great day to have that car parked right out front so everybody can see it. So that we can feel good about ourselves because of the possession that we have and the association that goes with that possession, making us feel that we are worth it. A feeling that we seek to generate independent of the worth that we have because of a relationship with God. It is number three in verse 16, boasting of what he has and does. All of this, by biblical definition, is worldliness. It is loving the system which has little or no place for God. Now, some of us who are here this morning grew up in a religious context where worldliness was defined in terms of certain forms of entertainment, or certain types of clothes, or perhaps some forbidden list of where we ought not go, or what we ought not do, or how we ought not look. I wish it were that simple. I really wish it were that easy. For the fact is that worldliness is far more subtle than that. Worldliness is far more difficult to contain than anything that can be written on a few lines of a piece of notebook paper. It's hard. It's hard to define what it is, because it sometimes slips and slides away from us. In fact, the ultimate irony is sometimes it can be a worldly thing to make a list of what are worldly things. And so it's counterproductive right off the top. But there is a way. There is a way in which we can practically and regularly get hold of this slippery thing called worldliness to understand what it is, and then to decide whether we choose to go with it or to avoid it. It is to frequently ask the simple question, does this fit with loving God? Whatever this is this included or excluded in the love, commitment, and vows which I have made, an exclusive love to God that I, as a Christian, have? I think that honestly asking that question precipitates great changes in our lives. Asking the question, does this fit with my loving God, alters the movies that we see. It changes the places we go, the clothes that we wear, the way we choose to look, the things we stare at, for a lot is said about the things that we choose to stare at, the things we listen to, the music that we select, even the food that we eat and the beverages that we drink. All of those things of life can be defined in terms of the choice that is made in the exclusivity of love as expressed in the activity of love by asking the question, does this fit with loving God? Now, I know which activities are consistent and inconsistent with my exclusive love for Charlene, and so do you. You'd know quickly. You would observe on short notice whether I am inappropriate in my relationships to other women, in the way I look, in the way I speak, where I am, how I handle situations. You know, and I know. I mean, it's not really that hard to figure out, and I think it usually is not that hard to figure out in the specific instance whether or not it is worldliness in the sense that it is inappropriate to those who have made a vow of exclusive love to God. Now, in just a moment, we're going to leave this verse, and because we seek at Wooddale Church to study through the breadth of the Bible, it is unlikely that we're going to come back to it for a very, very long time. So I want to linger here just long enough to say that the things that this verse talks about are a big deal. It is very important, and it is also a major problem among Christians. Because I believe that there are lots of us who say that we love God. And while we really mean it, the truth is that every day of the week, we're out there flirting with other people and other things. And that flirtation is really quite inconsistent with the love that we avow that we have. And the truth is that we either love God or we don't love God. So let us not be spiritually unfaithful. Let us not be spiritual adulterers. Let us not dance around with other things that are inconsistent with the love that God has for us and the love that we have for God. Let's love Him. But let's really love Him so that we behave in a way that is consistent with the love that we profess. The third teaching about all this is in verse 17. It has to do with the durability of love. I think that the choice between loving God and loving the world is really made somewhat easier by the words that are in 1 John 2:17. It there states that the world and its desires pass away. They're temporary. But the man or the woman who does the will of God lives forever. I think that the choice has been made very clear by the last 45 years of history in Europe. At the conclusion of World War II, prior to the partition of Europe that we call the Iron Curtain, there were Christians both in the East and in the West. There were churches on the east side of the partition and churches on the west side of the partition. Both of them had to make choices choices on what it meant to deal with an exclusive love for God and the prevailing system, depending on which side of the Iron Curtain they live. On the East, there was a materialistic system of communism. And on the West, another materialistic system of capitalism. We are only now beginning to fully understand the differences that each has had in relationship to Christians and the church. We have discovered that the church in the Eastern Bloc countries is surprisingly large and surprisingly strong, and that the Christians there are surprisingly godly and spiritual in their relationships to God. By contrast, we are seeing that the church in Western Europe is frighteningly small, disastrously compromised, and that the strength of faith and relationship of godliness that are found in their counterparts in the East are very difficult to discover in their counterparts in the West. In both cases, I am convinced they are worldly systems. In both cases, I'm convinced that allegiance to the system is mutually exclusive to an allegiance with God. I know the stories, and you do as well, of those who have given up their families, many times their lives, who have had enormous sacrifices because they have said that they love God and live for God under a communist regime. But ironically, history is teaching us that the more powerful, the more seductive has been the regime of the West. And that is the system in which we live. And in a strange, strange way, it is apparently harder to have an exclusive love relationship with God under our system than it is under the atrocities and the persecutions of the other system. Those in communist lands came to understand something that I think we need to come to understand, and that is that all such worldly systems are transient. They are temporary. The world and its desires pass away. Now, that's a hard thing to practically realize when you're living there. It's a hard thing to deal with when it's an everyday consideration. It's hard to stand up against the system, especially against our system, which as part of it is telling us that instant gratification is always the way to go, and worry about the consequences and the problems of behavior and decisions later on when those consequences arrive. That in itself has been a disastrous pollution of our moral decisions and behavior. Indeed, the system that we have has great, great pressures and is seductive. It's also temporary. And we need to make our own choices of whether we are going to buy into any one of the world's systems or whether we are going to say that every one of them is exclusive of the kind of love that we profess for God. I would say that it is a wise thing to choose the permanent, to skip the temporary, to avoid the worldly and to pursue the eternal. I would say that what is best is that we every day and every way live out our love for God and then live forever. But it's not an easy choice. The pressures are great. It's hard to do. But the rewards are eternal. I invite you to bow your heads with me and for a moment of quiet, reflect on what here is taught in the Bible. And I invite you to tell God in a simple prayer, at least if you so choose, and this is the conviction of your heart. Tell him, I love you. Father, I really love you. And forsaking all others, I will cling to thee and to thee alone so long as we both shall live.